Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Yes Sir, Hater. As usual, my name is Mark, and I'm with...
Yeah, you're still with me, Mark. Dennis, from a very foggy, dull, grey Jersey, sadly, last few days. I think we've had our 3 days of summer.
Right, it's amazing because I think it was almost just yesterday that you were telling me it was sunny, it was hot,
yeah,
it was balmy.
No more.
Okay. No, I just want to state this for posterity's sake. It's a wonderful day because Manchester United just stuffed Liverpool 2-1.
I know.
And with that, we just jump and leapfrog over them, and they are now languishing in 16th position, while we are in lofty 14th position.
Well, Mark, I used to, years back, do a little bit of football betting, just small stuff, and I thought United would get something in the game, and I went into William Hill, and it was 3-1 for a draw, and 4.5-1 for United win. And I was 50-50, I split the thing, and I just had a £10 bet on the draw, which would have returned £40. So, small stakes, small income, but just a bit of fun. And so I did fancy him to get something out of the game. I just wish I would have backed him to win rather than draw. So I'm not surprised.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Yeah, no, really. I thought they would because... I think the manager's straight. I think he's working hard. And I think he probably now has worked out which players are going to put a shift in and which players he needs to, other players that he needs to unload. It's as simple as that.
Yep. Cool. Okay. So we are inching closer to our 52nd episode. It seems like an eternity that we get there. But I found something interesting that I wanted to talk about today. And I believe I did send you the article. It was a short article from teachtalk.com. And I will paste the link to the article for our listeners to access it so that they can read it. But this article essentially talks about the 40-40 rule. And then I want to just talk about it. Okay, but first we will talk about what exactly is the 40-40 rule. And then I just want to see how we can make this an evidence-based discussion so that we can get our listeners to think about how they can apply the 40-40 rule in their own teaching. Does that sound good?
Yeah. I've heard of similar framing before. And when you sent it to me, and I read it, I thought, it's very interesting. And there's lots of reasons. And we're going to have a meaty discussion on it, I think.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, let's set the context. The 40-40 rule, according to the author, was something that he came across when he was perusing a 400-page book, Understanding by Design. And I quote, "The question was simple enough. Of all the academic standards you are tasked with covering, what's important that students understand for the next 40 days? What's important that they understand for the next 40 months? And what's important that they understand for the next 40 years?" So I think the context here is this is a powerful way to really think about academic content. And that's something that I think most teachers struggle and grapple with. Is that something that you struggled with in your early days as in your teaching then?
Well, Mark, it was so long ago, there wasn't exponential knowledge we were hunting and gathering. So apart from using a bow and arrow and how to fillet a bass or a salmon, there wasn't really anything else. I'm kind of exaggerating a bit, but certainly in the 60s when I was at school, I don't think we're talking about exponential knowledge and cognitive overload, but it is now, I would say, one of our biggest challenges is you cannot put a pint of liquid into a half pint glass. And now we're talking about trying to put 50 gallons into an half pint pot. So exponential growth of knowledge we still have. And we can go back at least 300,000 years for those of us who tend to think evolution. Thousand years ago, it was pretty much 50 years No, 50,000 years ago, we didn't have to worry too much about kind of reading books and kind of internet and whatever. So we really are in a absolute mire here, and lots of people have written on it. And the solutions we can talk about, there is no final solution to this, is just ways of coping with it, I feel. The 40-40 rule you talked about, understanding by design, that comes from the work of McTighe and Wiggins.
Yep.
I'm fully familiar with their work, and did have dinner once with Grant Wiggins at a conference we were working at. And that work is very, very solid. And they do talk about trying to teach the big ideas and using the big questions, and it's very clear, clearly related to one of the core principles of learning, which we'll explore later. But yeah, they did a lot of very good work in helping teachers to make sense of trying to deal with what do we put in the curriculum, how do we structure it, and how do we teach. Yeah,
yeah, okay. So you have covered the first one, which is really to answer the basic question, which is what exactly do we teach students in the amount of content that we are supposed to cover? And you have just rightly pointed out one of the biggest problems is actually there's tons of knowledge, and we are inundated or bombarded with it nonstop, especially with the internet. Somebody just does a bit of a search, goes to Wikipedia and thinks they know everything. So the second one is big issue of what to teach and for what purpose. I think this is something that I want you to expound on. But for a moment before you do that, I'm just going back to the article. And they have, and the author has really essentially broken down the 40-40 rule as nice to know, important content, and enduring understandings. Now, going back to the second issue, does this help clarify that a bit more?
Yeah, it does, because the thing is, we know that certain things that are probably going to apply in the future. For the simple fact is, they're probably predicated on how the universe works. Now, it's probably the case that you could travel anywhere in the universe and you'll find carbon. Probably the would have obviously influenced by other contextual factors. I tend to think, and it worries me a bit, but you'd probably find predation if there's life. The enduring understandings in the subject, yep, you're teaching maths and physics and, you know, biology to a large extent. A lot of what you the art now, if you're teaching out the art with H, okay, remember I'm from East London, how the heart works and how the brain works. If you're teaching that, we know more about how it works, but it's not going to change how the body works, how physics work, mathematical stuff. Those key concepts in those subjects are certainly endearing knowledge. Once you start getting into IT, that will become more challenging, but there's probably key aspects of IT that are still enduring. In other words, if you're talking about software, any piece of software will have a structure, it will have menus, it will have navigation. So it's basically, that's what they're talking about. And that's probably what they mean by, well, I'm pretty certain that's what they mean by the enduring knowledge. The key concepts and principles that are fundamental to understanding the structure of a topic, which is an evidence-based core principle of learning. And that is becoming more and more important, because I will make a case a bit later that a lot of what we teach in school, we simply shouldn't be teaching.
Right. Okay. So I'm glad you brought that up. So let's separate the woods from the trees. How does a teacher decide that? Because I think there are, you know, with any good teacher, I want to cover this content. But how does he or she actually make a decision of which content falls into which bucket, which 40 bucket? Good to have, nice to know, important and enduring understanding.
You're asking me that question. Well, quite simply, any good teacher, and this is where we start talking about pedagogic literacy here.
Yeah.
And also, you must have good subject content knowledge, one, but you must have what Shulman called pedagogic content knowledge, and that is the ability to look at your subjects and say, well, what are the key concepts and principles? For example, we are doing this podcast weekly on evidence-based creative teaching, and we are very clear about the big understandings, and one of the big understandings of what we do is how the brain works.
Yeah.
How it works, particularly in relation to the mind, because we don't really, as teachers, need to understand the neuroscience, but we must understand the cognitive science, because that's how experience is processed. Ultimately, knowledge, understandings, etc., get hardwired in the brain. So, yep. A key concept of what we do is how does the mind work in terms of processing information and transferring that information into solid neural structures through the interaction between working memory and long-term memory, right? Another key concept or principle that we have is that, well, let's look at what teaching methods work best. And John Attee is famous for doing that, but others have done the same. And to say, well, hold on, if we understand cognitive science, if we understand what teaching methods work best and we can calibrate those two, that gives us our best frame, our guiding heuristics on how to design and facilitate learning events. So, you know, so we've worked that out. Teachers have got to do the same in their own subjects. And for teachers who have not really developed the skill of doing that, they need to develop that. Otherwise, they're just teaching lots of facts and lots of bits of knowledge, and that's not going to be good.
Okay. So I think you wrote this quote, and I'm going to read it. I think that captures the problem. Human beings have, it's by Ringer, I think, if I pronounce the name correctly, human beings have the potential for developing in many directions, and the problem of educational aims is deciding which kinds of development should be fostered and which discouraged. So what you just said, doesn't that mean it's a fruitless and meaningless task?
Well, not really. Ringe, I think it's pronounced.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it's different cultures, it would be ringy in some cultures.
Ringy,
yeah,
yes.
I mean, the basic thing is we have to make a decision. At the end of the day, we have to socialise our young. I mean, other animals do to some extent, but we have to do it through language and through rules of behaviour. And, you know, I kind of got frustrated with certain Westerners when I lived in Singapore, and I'd come back to the West. And they said, yeah, how can you live in Singapore? It's an experiment in social engineering. And I'm saying to them, hold on a minute. Every culture is an experiment in social engineering. It's just one could argue that they're better than others. So I had many political, philosophical, and moral arguments, and I certainly don't think in the UK now that we are doing a great job in terms of making these decisions, because there is so much plurality, and I'm not against plurality, but somewhere down the line, you have to make decisions. What are going to be your core values? What are you going to teach students? What are the domains of knowledge that are most relevant and skills? And it can become a real mess.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I think to back you up, I'm going to read a quote that you actually gave me by our ex-Prime Minister, Mr. Goh Chok Tong, who in 1997, yeah, at the opening of the 7th International Conference on Thinking, yeah, said we must get away from the idea that it is only the people at the top who should be thinking, and the job of everybody else is to do as told. Instead, we want to bring about a spirit of innovation, of learning by doing, of everybody, each at his level, all the time asking how he can do his job better.
Yeah, were you there? I was at that conference, and I've met him a couple of times. Actually, really nice chap. Had a long chat with his wife once at the airport. I was waiting to get served at the Deli France, and suddenly the girl that was going to serve me stopped and served this lady instead, who had a couple of beefy guys behind her. And I'm just looking, and she kind of apologised to me and said, really sorry about that. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it happened to be Goh Chok Tong's wife. And I had a chat with her for about 20 minutes because she was waiting for, I think, her son to come in. And that was just like having a chat in the coffee shop with someone. And what I liked about that quote is that Singapore, for me, the idea, well, let's get, you know, thinking schools, learning nation, that was the mission, wasn't it? The big theme at the time. And if we get people to think better at every level, saying, how can we do something more effective, more creative to improve the work of society? I just thought that was so good. And I worked on that project of Thinking Schools, Learning Nations, and I think you did as well, for many years. It still continues as a key theme in Singapore, I think.
Yeah, I think we do. It's just that you don't maybe necessarily hear the word Thinking School, Learning Nation as a buzzword anymore, but I think the idea is there. And we have, I think, to be fair, we have shifted, I wouldn't use the word radically, but over time, moving away from content absorption to a lot more of forcing people to think. And I think right now is also going to require a bit of a cultural reset where we look at students taking responsibility. And we have talked about this in terms of self-directed learning, but also to practice a lot more metacognition, taking control of how they are, taking control of the kind of techniques they are doing to regulate their thinking. So let's shift gears a little bit and let's look at this issue from a cultural analysis. Concept?
Cultural analysis perspective, yeah. My namesake, Dennis Lawton, yeah. Quite famous. And again, making significant points. How do you read Dennis Lawton's approach? What do you see as the big question there?
Okay, so what he says is you need to consider the wider context of society in curriculum decision making. So I think in Singapore's context is the powers that be are for the Ministry of Education. They will be the ones that decide what to learn, who to learn what, in terms of making the curriculum decision. So I think politics also comes into play, because I was just reading a very interesting article in the news, the mainstream media. And you'll be interested to know, did you know that the Hong Kong government has actually removed any reference in the history books of Hong Kong ever being a British colony?
No, I didn't know that. That kind of rewriting history is something that is happening in the UK. You may remember these folk pulling down statues of people that were supposedly kind of slave traders in the 18th, 19th century, and we want to change history. I mean, I do... I don't really subscribe much to that at all. We can learn from history, but let's not... I mean, the argument I used to make to these people, well, why don't we go over to Iceland or wherever it was and start battering them? Because the Vikings came over in the 5th or 6th century and they were famous for rape and pillage, apparently. I'm not old enough to remember that. But, you know, am I going to blame, you know, what happened in the 6th century? And the thing is, this is a major problem that we're having, I think, in society, is to keep looking back and finding someone to blame and punishing them, rather than saying, well, how do we not make the same mistakes and then try to educate people better? Are we going to go back? I mean, if we evolve from, you know, species of apes or whatever, lizards or fish, are we going to go back and blame, you know, a catfish because, did something to one of our smaller fish? I mean, it's just, I don't buy into that anyway.
Yeah, but you see, you can't run away from the fact that many factors actually shape curriculum. And this could include, as I would just give you the example, political ideology, right?
Oh, absolutely,
So as we say, Hong Kong was never ever a British colony. Then you have dominant educational perspectives. One year it's constructivism, another year it's no, constructivism is out, let's look at cognitive based learning. Another year it's no, let's look at evidence based perspectives. So I think really, how then do you really decide? And I want to do a quote which I think you shared as well, which I love it. And this is by Collins, who writes, "We educators can't go on adding things to the school curriculum as knowledge grows exponentially. We can't keep people in school longer and longer until everybody needs several advanced degrees just to deal with the complexity they face in their lives. We can't make our textbooks much fatter than they already are. Actually, I would disagree because everything now is digitalized and cover more and more topics in the same amount of time. Our strategies for coping with the exponential growth of knowledge is hitting a wall. I thought that was quite brilliant.
Yeah, well, that's right. It's absolutely the case. There's so many aspects to this. You've got that going on, and there's something called artificial intelligence, and which is going to be able to manage data, do learning analytics, and come up with algorithms, and many, many jobs. And certainly, I think a lot of higher education is going to be massively hit by that. What's going to happen is people are going to get 5 degrees and still not get a job because more and more jobs are being taken away and put into some artificial intelligence
But that's innately the problem, right? They may be smarter, and I use the word smarter in inverted commas, in terms of the breadth of knowledge, but they can't think, right? They probably know a little bit of everything, but they can't actually think or do any kind of depth or, you know, any kind of deep work.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a contested area. You've got people, I think, like Martin Ford, who see it as a kind of, the jobs are going to be it, not just. Yeah. In fact, the jobs that are going to be least it will be things like carers and people like that, because it's hard to get robots to do those jobs. But certainly he feels it's going to hit a lot of middle class kind of jobs, radiography, accounting, and lots of the stuff that people do in admin and that kind of stuff. You think you're probably better off being a plumber or a carer now than many other jobs that perhaps require high level academic qualifications. So there's big debate in that area, and then there's the debate that says, well, everybody should be educated anyway to develop their mind, that should be a human right or whatever. I'm all for people being more educated, but we will have moral judgments and political judgments about what constitutes the educated person. I mean, I think my views, and I think if we can get people to be more metacognitive, to have better literacy, political literacy, but not from an ideological base, but from a kind of more eclectic sort of, what are the underlying premises of political thinking? So I think we've got to look at how we make sense of different areas and domains, and what are the underlying assumptions and methodologies. People, it's a new form of literacy, and we could do 10 podcasts on that.
Yeah, because if you think about it, I think Collins goes on to say the school curriculum is filled with stuff that most people will never use and hence will forget as soon as they leave school or move on to the next grade. That's a bit sad, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, let's take some examples here. I mean, we are evidence-based, and we try to speak from an evidence-based point of view. If I look at the teaching of maths, right, from when I did O-level maths to, I think what's taught today is there's nothing wrong with the maths curriculum. But what you have to say to yourself, do all kids need to learn lots of stuff like algebra and trigonometry and other stuff? Should that not be later on in the school curriculum when people choose to do GCSE maths? And does everybody need to do GCSE maths? And it's the same with English. I mean, we talk about learning Shakespeare and learning all this stuff. Do we want to be teaching that to 11, 12, 13-year-olds? Wouldn't it be better to teach them how to read better, how to write better, and how to listen better, and how to speak better? So I think there could be a reframing of lots of curriculum areas. And so what are the key aspects of these subjects that really apply in the real world, and teach them? So that would reduce the curriculum for a lot. And then obviously if people choose to go on to do GCSEs and A-level English, then it would be more deeper into the domain, the Erston Peters argument of the development of mind through forms of knowledge. So yeah, what are we teaching in schools has to be looked at in terms of the amount of content, certainly, and the utility of that content for the next sort of 40 days and the next 40 years. And that's where it will be enduring aspects of a subject. We know that when you speak, things like clarity, conciseness, emphasis, tone, these kind of things are core things. And I think that, you know, the same applies to most subjects.
Okay. Which brings us to the next part about 21st century skills. And I know we did touch about this a little bit in terms of, we did allude to it in our previous episodes. Can't remember which number. But I think there's a rising importance for us to also cover that in terms of the content to cover in terms of 21st century knowledge and skills. Your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, well, this has been a massive area, and it's still ongoing. And even the top, well, when I say the top, this is subjective, isn't it? But people like Yuval Noah Harari, one of the people that writes extensively about not just historical analysis, but in his book Homo Deus, if you read that, very thick book, yep. Superbly yep. written and very thought provoking. And I think he's written another one, which I read, 29 problems or things to consider for the 21st century. He basically makes the point that to actually try to predict what the world's going to be like in some 20, 30 years is just impossible. The rate of change and the amount of discontinuities going around the world, we just don't know. That the kind of, you know, the macro theories of, you know, sociology, if you think of like structural functionalism, kind of Marxism, these were macro theories that try to explain how societies evolve and develop over time and what things can happen. But I think at the moment, you know, it's called post-modernity, isn't it? It's a worrying term because it can lead to a sense of, well, everything goes and we can't really talk about reality in any meaningful way. So, and that can drift into real relativism and nihilism. So we're in the situation where we can't really predict what's going to happen in the future. I mean, there's certain things that we can say are big concerns, and certain we do know that technology is going to develop in some way, that things are going to become sort of more effective, more efficient, more elaborate, new things, and, you know, the combining of genetics with IT and perhaps with the mind, you know, what's called the GRIN technology, genetic robotics, IT and nanotechnology. So there's the technological development is going to happen. How that's going to impact all aspects of the economy, occupation and social life and relationships. I saw a podcast. He's making the prediction that companies will be able to hack into humans and know us better than we know ourselves based on our behavior. I mean, there's so much going on. We know that. We know that the environment is under threat. We know that we have to deal with, you know, global conflicts. I mean, like we have at the moment, and how we deal with those. So these are things that we can predict. So what are we teaching around this? Certainly, we've got to teach people, I think, to have the ability to adapt to change, how to deal with, to become more resilient as people, and certainly to take responsibility. And I did listen to a podcast of Viktor Frankl, who I've read pretty much all of his work, but one of his podcasts, and it would have been about, he would have made it about 30, well, it wasn't a podcast, it was a video of him, sorry. And what he's basically saying, this is a really interesting point I think people need to consider. He talks about being in Auschwitz, when he was in Auschwitz for 4.5 years. And what he basically said is very few people actually committed suicide, even though the conditions were harsh, because a lot of them could buy into the meaning of, can we survive? So issues to do with kind of mental health issues weren't the issue. The issue was, how do we survive another day in this environment? And what he compares it with, talking about Austria at the time, was about teachers reporting that something like 40% of students had talked about suicide. And he's kind of saying, well, hold on a minute. This is a society that's affluent, welfare state, and youngsters are kind of thinking about suicide. And yet people in Auschwitz didn't do that. And his argument is that the problem with society today is that so many needs are being met and we're pandering so much to the young and, oh, well, oh, we mustn't annoy and we mustn't offend and we must, you know, the it's almost the Larry Wingate snowflake argument. And the point is not challenging our youngsters and not making them take responsibility and pandering to, you know, their different multiple needs and their different concepts of identity. We're actually creating all of the mental health and, you know, problem issues. So that's an interesting frame. So, you know, if there's some validity in that, we may have to think about kind of the nature of not just what we teach, but how we teach and the kind of modus operandi of schools away from kind of what it is increasingly prevalent in certain Western societies. It's a challenging one, but it's you know, there's evidence to say that we've got to really look at the evidence and see how best we address these futuristic directions.
Yeah, so I think you do mention also, I think we have talked about this also, the importance of really maybe having metacognitive capability. Yeah, and I don't know, maybe down the road, we need to revisit this concept one more time. And to maybe teach it as a superordinate competence. And really, once the I think students get a good grasp of this, this might help them, I think, as you argue, in terms of getting them to be a bit better in terms of the way they learn and in terms of better thinkers. So does that consider as one of the 40, you think, metacognitive, as the extreme 40 for enduring effects?
I would put that at the top of the list. Students have got to understand how the mind works and be able to see that what they're going through issues are existentially valid, that in a sense, being a young person, particularly today, and trying to find meaning, trying to find purpose, trying to make sense of this the VUCA world is hard, and but they're gonna have to deal with it. It's kind of you know, they're gonna have to learn, they're gonna have to put effort in, and by just trying to make life so comfortable for them in the kind of shortage, that's it's not good. It's like somebody who's super unfit and keep kind of treating them with cotton wool. Somehow they've got to get in the gym and they've got to get the weights and getting on the bike, and it's a little bit like what is it? I think John Rowan said that, you know, he's one of these kind of coaches in motivational theory. You know, that at the end of the day, if everything was easy, then there wouldn't be successful people. I mean, to be successful, to be good at something, takes, Anthony Robbins' terms, massive effort. And we've got to get away from the fact that you know, we can't just say, oh, everybody is special, everybody is kind of successful, as a generalized statement. Yeah, we can make success and special individual to individuals, but not as a kind of norm across the board. It's like competition. If you know, we have football matches, and let's be honest about it, imagine if there was no, that every team got points and it didn't matter whether you won or you didn't. You know, the idea of, yeah, at the end of the day, people have got to find meaning in playing for the local football team and in getting enjoyment out of that and not getting dispirited because they don't get in the Manchester City side or even the Manchester United side now. I mean, there's a big point here that kind of there's a paradox here of trying to be individual centred but reality centred, that we have to put a shift in the real world to achieve our goals.
Right. Okay. Okay. So I thought we would just do a bit of a wrap up for this part here by looking at what the author originally recommends for teachers or educators to think about as they try and decide how they would want to place their 40-40-40 in their own classroom. So which knowledge or skills are good to have, which one is important to have, and which one is more enduring. So I'm going to read what he suggests. I don't think by any means it is evidence-based. It's probably from his own experience. But I thought it would be worth talking about it. So the first one that he says is, which is actually quite interesting. And I'll do one and two together because I think they're related. So it says, number one, how to apply the 40-40 rule in your classroom. Number one, start out alone. It is helpful to clarify what you think about the curriculum before the world joins you. So analyze it alone. Think about it carefully rather than simply being polite and accepting everything. So that's number one. And then number two is, after you have sketched out the thinking about what you need to teach, then do the discussion and come to a conclusion, or have a professional learning community meeting with colleagues and with colleagues to then decide what content to teach. So your thoughts on one and two?
Well, there's a little bit of naiveness there. When you start alone, you don't, do you? You know, individuals will start off with their own experiences, their own beliefs, and they will see things that their topic is more important. They might have particular kind of views about those kind of things. It's like teaching social science, you know, or teaching religious education. People with vested interests or prior socialization will see it in that way. It's a bit of cultural analysis, isn't it? So, teachers have got to work together, and they've got to look at the domain in which they're in. And they've also got to recognize that their domain is one domain with other subjects. I mean, who was it who said, Kelly, curriculum is a battlefield of conflicting ideas? I actually think that sort of psychology, well, again, what type of psychology? I actually think that key understandings in psychology and bits of sociology could be core within a social science module, more important than subjects that are kind of less focused on the here and now and how we manage ourselves and understand ourselves. So I would probably have quite a lot of very basic cognitive science in the school curriculum, particularly to do with how we learn and how we manage ourselves and why the brain doesn't always seem to work terribly well and how we deal with the complexity of being, if you like. I mean, and these things can be made practical, and students will understand them because they're going through that internal chaos and trying to make sense of the world. So these kind of areas of psychology, I think, would be core. But other people say, oh, no, that's too abstract. It's more important that they learn about Romeo and Juliet or about the Aztecs or, you know, mountain ranges in Peru. I mean, really, I mean, you know, it makes for a good debate, doesn't it? And that's what we are opening up here. And again, I think the point about what's our purpose? Yeah, our curriculum has got to be focused on educational attainment, however we define it. And I do think the idea to get better relationships with themselves, whatever the self is, and with other people, and to be able to earn a living and to be able to be healthy and well-being. Let's teach people how to be healthier. You know, in England, I think we spend more money on type 2 diabetes than on the Iraq war and the war in terror. We're supposed to have health education. Something's not working.
Yep. Okay. So number three, he suggests just keep it simple. Do a three-column graphic organizer. What's good? What's good to have? What's important and what's enduring? So I think that simply is honestly the easiest way of doing it. Okay. So, but I think the problem with that is, qualifies himself by saying, be flexible, because even if you do that, there is no, in my opinion, and I'm not sure if you agree, there is no 100% objective way of doing it, because you will have to be flexible, because you would have had different experiences from, let's say, colleagues who might be teaching the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and this is where the issue really is. I mean, there's so much kind of plurality around so many. I've come back to the UK and there's a constant discussion about how many genders there are. So you've actually got people saying there's dozens and dozens of genders and this needs to be dealt with or negotiated with children at the ages of 5 and 6. And then you have, we talked a little while back on Peterson, And, you know, he argues, well, there's two genders, basically, only two genders. But obviously people can kind of, a bit of a mixture, but the, you know, how many genders are there? I mean, where do we get, you know, where is there going to be a consensus? Are we going to have an exploration of multiple genders with five-year-olds as part of the school curriculum or not? I won't give you my views on that because I'm no expert on it, but I'm a bit concerned by that notion. Not to say that there are people are have different sexual orientations. There's no issue with that, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, we might be creating complexity and confusion that is not useful. I mean, that's just a frame, isn't it? People would disagree with that frame, and we can argue till the cows come home, yep, even if it's only got sheep on the farm.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe let's summarize this. Let's wrap up our discussion here. Let's do this in a meaningful manner. One is from an evidence-based perspective, when you talk about 40-40-40 rule, is really just go back to one of the core principles that we have always talked about, and I have a huge proponent of, and that is teach only the key concepts. And that's why I've always issued challenges to our listeners. Are you able to sit down and boil down your topic area to the most 2 to 3 concepts? And I've actually issued that challenge. So I don't know if any listeners have actually tried it. The more I read about this and the more of the discussion that we just had, it just convinces me that, you know, core principle where we need to not teach to the content, but essentially teach the concepts, key concepts, actually is more effective than just trying to teach in a more linear fashion.
Yeah, 100%, Mark. And if you take mind mapping, right, yep, the concept of a mind map, when that's done well, on one page, you can capture almost all the key aspects of the domain. So if we put evidence-based teaching in the middle, the key branches would be how humans learn, what teaching methods work best. Yep. Then from then you can develop the branches. So if we say cognitive scientific principles is such a superordinate sort of set of concepts, a principle, and then it can split off into challenging goals, working with memory, teaching key concepts. So you can actually, well, get a complete topic area, a big topic area on one. That is an extension of that. So getting students to learn the core concepts and then to be able to map those in their own mind and to develop those kind of mind maps and do the repeated practice, and then they can get a good understanding, a sense of mastery, and that will create more interest. And that's what we need to do. We've got to get students to understand the key concepts, because if they don't, the subject's always going to be a mystery, isn't it? And it's going to be frustrating to learn.
Yep. Okay. Then you also mentioned about the need to teach metacognition.
Oh, well, yep. You know, I mean, my most recent book, it's got a long chapter in it. I think it's over 100 pages long. It is the most, good communication skills, fundamental collaboration is important. Relationship building is important. But the whole ability to manage the what we call the self, to self-regulate, to find meaning, to be able to develop as a person, to get congruence between what we want to be and what we're actually doing, manage our learning better, balance our lives, which has become, metacognition is our central concept to teaching. More I look at what's going on in the world, more I feel that to be the case. I felt it was the case for quite a while, and that's why we did so much research on it. And
right,
it becomes such an anchor point, because metacognition helps to manage the whole thinking process, the critical thinking process, creativity, the emotional aspects, and all the barriers that are both systemic to the brain and that we've learned from our prior socialization. So it is such a big area.
Right. And then, of course, learning to learn strategies. And last but not least,
yeah, all part of it. It all comes under that. To be able to say, right, this is what I need to learn. What are the types of things other than learn is maintain your that you can't just go headlong for hours because you'll get frustrated. All the things like interleaving, all the things like having some kind of strategy that if it doesn't work, you can look at other strategies, maintaining relationships with other people who can help. All of those kind of links of knowledge sources that you can bring in, support sources. It's all governed by metacognition.
Yep. Okay. And last but not least, of course, is learn how to manage emotions. Well, I know we didn't really talk so much about it, but maybe you can just do a quick wrap up. Yeah.
We can do it because it's the metacognition that manages emotions, and it's so easy for you. You know, for example, something happens to you that gets you annoyed. The ability to say, "Look, how much annoyance am I going to spend on this?" Okay, for example, I might get caught in a traffic jam, and it means that I kind of miss 20 minutes of the football and TV. Okay, I might be a bit annoyed, but let's not get in a temper and have an argument with someone and get depressed for 2 days. I used to play social cricket here in the UK years ago, and I wasn't that keen on the game. I played to make the numbers up, and obviously I played to win. But I used to see people, we go for a drink afterwards, and if we'd lost a cricket game, they're all night, they're whinging, they'll go home, probably have a row with with people in the household. Is it worth it? So let's not, let's not sweat the small stuff. But that's hard to do. You have to work hard at not doing it. Otherwise, it's so easy for the emotional, the limbic system to keep kicking in everywhere. And all you're doing is just getting annoyed over stuff rather than saying, well, hold on, let's try and learn from experience. But don't sweat the small stuff, because sooner or later you're going to suffer with something serious. And that's when you have to really be able to dig in and find some way of dealing with that.
Yep. Okay, so that wraps up our discussion on the 40-40-40 rule. So let's go on to my favorite segment of the podcast, and that is something that we found interesting that we have read, shared, watched, or maybe dabbled with. You want to go first then?
Yeah, well, I'm keeping this a secret because, as you know, it's going to be over the next couple of weeks. We're going to be talking about the e-tools. Every week you come up with something that seems useful. I've been putting together a bit of a format and to start to do a bit of retrieval practice on what are some of the key e-tools in the three main genres of technology, delivery, communication, collaboration, and assessment. So I'm working on going through some of these e-tools and coming up with a question format, which are we kicking in with that next week, or do you want another week?
Sure, we can do that next week. Not a problem. If we are ready, we can do that.
Yeah, I will obviously send you the structure.
Okay.
Because I do think, we're doing so many, we're up to what is it, 42 podcasts now? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, we are already at 48, I think.
Oh, 48.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's things to revisit and there's connections to be made, because if people are coming on now, they probably are not going to go back and look at 47 hours of podcasts. So,
but they should.
That's right. But the thing is, it's cognitive load, isn't it? Everybody wants everything in bite-sized chunks. Unfortunately, you can't learn brain surgery with bite-sized chunks, unfortunately. But you can, but it's a lot of bite-sized chunks, right? We'll spend the next couple of weeks kind of looking at, we have our framework for evidence-based teaching, how it applies to the use of technology. So we will refresh that, and then we say, well, okay, well, given we want to activate prior knowledge, given that we want to provide feedback, what are the tools for that? If we want to deliver content, what are the best e-tool combinations, both that are free and maybe not free? So we'll pull that whole area together, because I think a lot of people be interested in that.
Yeah, okay. So I wanted to share,
yeah.
I wanted to share this tool that I came across on social media, which I think is quite brilliant. I've not actually tried it, but I promise I will do so. It's called Pictory.ai. AI standing for artificial intelligence. And here's some of the things that Pictory can do for you, which is brilliant. All you need to do is write a script and then put it through the AI, and it simply searches Pictory's vast library of over 3 million royalty-free video clips, images, and music to automatically create the perfect video for you. Can you imagine that? You can add your own voice or choose one of their incredibly lifelike AI voices. And I just checked the pricing. You can do for free 3 20-minute videos for free. And so if you are trying to teach somebody something, all you need to do is just type it in a script and it creates the video for you. How cool is that? You don't even need to have cameras. You don't need to set up anything.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is amazing. I've got the job, haven't I, of going through 47 episodes of your Heat or Whistle. I won't be able to go through all of them, but I'm going to try and have a good dip, and then we'll start the conversation, and we'll see if we can come up with some map of all these holes, and to get them, so a kind of sort of mind map and key concepts. So let's put together the key concepts and principles for learning, and let's see if we can these tools and which we can sell to people, right? Okay, now we give it away free because we, you know, we're educational philanthropists, aren't we?
Yeah, okay,
but so we'll work on that concept anyway. We won't say where that goes. I think we can let's put together the best conceptual arrangement of technology for learning and how different tools contribute to different aspects of the learning process. So the creative aspect is for people to be able to put in together, blend them, you know, the Atti, Rush and Dole concept in relation to their subject content curriculum. And all we can do is provide the front skill in doing that, isn't it?
Yep. Okay. Cool. So... yep, that ends today's this week's podcast. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. We always enjoy doing this. So if you are listening to this and you are a regular listener, can I please encourage, or can we please encourage you to please like and share this on your social media so that we can reach out to more people. And as always, you can also write to us at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. Once again, evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. So that's a wrap. We are getting one step closer to episode 52. Then you need to start thinking about what we are going to do for episode 52, which really means that's 1 year's worth of work. We should do something really fun. Maybe we should think about stories, humorous stories about teaching and learning that, you know, that we have come and what we have learned from them. Maybe that could be our 52nd episode.
Yeah, that's right. So we're going to do the technology aspect in the next two episodes, and then we'll do that one. So that's going to test our creativity.
Yep, definitely. But let's try and do that.
Yeah, we will. Yeah, we'll do it. Absolutely.
Cool. Okay, so you take care. Yeah. Spurs are grinding out results, and we'll see. Hopefully they you know, win a trophy this season, but not at the expense of Manchester United, of course. But
yeah, so. Yeah. I mean that's good, isn't it? And I did watch the Newcastle Manchester City game, and one of the best footballs I've seen in the last decade. That was just an unbelievable match.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So you have a good rest of the week, and we'll chat soon. So take care, everyone, and bye-bye.
And bye from me.